Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. How's this for a wake-up call? When you get up tomorrow morning, it will be exactly 1 month until tax day. April 15th is fast approaching, ready or not. As millions of Americans ready their returns, many can't help wonder if the system is fair. So does Charles Rosati, and he's the former commissioner of the IRS. When it comes to the tax system, he says, America is winning the battle and losing the war. Tonight on Point, an ex-IRS chief says the U.S. tax system is growing more and more unfair to the vast majority of U.S. taxpayers. But first, we begin tonight with an update on the so-called alternate minimum tax, created 35 years ago so the ultra-wealthy would pay their fair share. Today, it's not the super-rich who are paying the AMT. It's a far more modest earner getting hit. And by 2010, it is estimated that as many as 30 million taxpayers will owe the alternative minimum tax, including 94% of married filers with incomes between $75,000 and $100,000. Jim McTague is Washington editor of Barron's and joins me now. Jim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, Tom. I've had two shocking things happen to me in this, my 55th year.
And those would be?
Well, number one, I went to Florida and I got a senior citizen rate at the movie, which I found very shocking.
Sorry,
even,
Jim.
Even worse, I did my taxes. I'm a journalist. I got hit by the AMT.
Describe to us how it works. You do all your deductions and then something else kicks in.
Well, I did something stupid this year. I took a capital gain. Years ago, back in the 80s, I worked for a brokerage firm for 2 years to get my financial expertise. And I bought stock in the company at that time. And, you know, over the years, it built up from, say, 100 shares to about 700 shares.
Yeah.
Nice nest egg. But I cover Washington, but I also have begun to write company stories. And I didn't want any kind of conflict of interest. So I wanted to sell that stock and put the money in a mutual fund.
So did it mean that you became a zillionaire this year and that's why you got hit?
Yeah, it means that I had a giant capital gain. And what happens is it boosted my income, my joint income to the point that I got hit by the AMT. And then they turn around and they recalculate my capital gains tax at an AMT rate of 26%. So they're goodbye 15% capital gains rate. I feel like an idiot for not consulting my accountant before I sold the stock.
Now, Jim, I'm being a little facetious saying that you must be a zillionaire to be hit with that. I guess the whole point is it was intended for quite wealthy Americans, and it is now hitting whom?
Well, I make under $200,000 a year, and it hit me. And this year, 12.7 million taxpayers are going to get hit by the AMT versus 3 million in 2001.
And what's it likely to cost if you're calculating your taxes and suddenly you factor it in?
It's going to cost me between $2,000 and $5,000. We haven't figured it out yet, but I have to write a check to the IRS in excess of everything that's been taken out of my paycheck all year.
Now, if this was intended to make sure that the very rich were paying, and it's now hitting something closer to an upper middle class, and what we're reading here is that it will eventually, with inflation, I guess, it will hit much at the center of a middle class. Why hasn't something been done about it?
Well, yeah, originally it was for 155 taxpayers, by the way.
Back in 1965.
Yes. And because Congress doesn't deal with a crisis until it explodes. And so this year the president appointed his tax panel, and supposedly they'll come up with a solution, a rational tax system, sometime this year. And I think next year, the anniversary of the Reagan tax cuts, you know, 2006, 1986, Congress and Bush will attempt to replace the current tax system.
Jim, we've heard a lot about tax cuts during the Bush administration, but this AMT sounds like a kind of stealth tax increase.
Well, it is if you live in a high-income state like tax states like California or New York, because when you compute the AMT, you have a deduction. Now, the deduction on the high end is $58,000 for a joint.
So if you're deducting high state taxes, it's likely to trigger the AMT.
Yeah, your mortgage deduction, your deduction for dependents, all that. If you add all that stuff up and your tax breaks exceed $58,000, you get hit by the AMT. If it were indexed for inflation, you would get $158,000 in deductions.
How big a revenue source is it for the federal government today? Is the government dependent on this stealth tax?
Yeah, it's a stealth flat tax. And the government is so dependent on it, and you know, I'm relying on statistics from the Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Rosati's taxpayer advocate, Nina Olson,
yes,
put out a report, and she says that it would cost less money now to eliminate the regular tax system than keep the AMT than to abolish the AMT. If Congress decided to do away with the AMT, they would lose $85 billion in tax revenues a year.
So not likely to do it soon, but you imagine it might be addressed in 06.
They've got to, or otherwise they're going to be marched to the scaffold by all its Robespierres.
Yeah. We hear it, Jim McTague. Sorry for that senior citizen pass to the movies, and sorry about the AMT. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jim McTague, Washington editor for Barron's. He spoke with me from Washington. For 5 years, under two presidencies, from 1997 to 2002, Charles Rosati held one of the most unpopular jobs in the country, IRS commissioner. He took an agency in trouble and launched major changes. But now that he's returned to the private sector, he's got a lot to say. The American tax system, he says, is broken, unfair, and getting worse. The burden is falling more and more on the backs of hard-working average Joes, he says, while bigwig tax dodgers and tax shelter pros go on their merry way. This hour on Point, an ex-IRS chief says it's time for honest taxpayers to demand a change. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you sat down yet to do the deed, to file your taxes? And what's your response when the former chief of the IRS says the whole system is becoming more and more unfair to the vast majority of taxpayers, maybe to you? You can join it at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Charles Rosati. From 97 to 02, he served as IRS commissioner and is now a member of President Bush's advisory panel for income tax reform. As co-founder, former chairman, and CEO of American Management Systems, he was the first straight-up businessman ever to be brought in to run the IRS. He's now a senior advisor at the Carlyle Group. His new book is Many Unhappy Returns, One Man's Quest to Turn Around the Most Unpopular Organization in America. Charles Rosati, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here, Tom.
So you were a brave guy. You came in and took over the IRS. You didn't have to do that. Why'd you do it?
Well, I did it mainly because Bob Rubin, who was then the Treasury Secretary, made an argument that there was a crisis that could be turned into an opportunity to improve the way the IRS works. And it is an agency that affects just about everybody in America. In fact, more people than any other organization in America. So I bought his argument, and I think it turned out to be true, at least as far as the IRS itself was concerned.
So the first thing you wanted to prove was that you could bring in management techniques and a sharp eye and actually do something about an agency, the IRS, that in the late 90s was under huge criticism, just a tidal wave. Remind us of that time and why there was so much public uproar over the IRS.
Well, it actually had been going downhill for a number of years. You may not remember, but in the 70s and 80s, the IRS may not have been loved, but it was reasonably respected, and the public's ratings were not worse than they were for other government agencies. And it just began to drop over a period of years. By the time I got there, complaints were pouring into Congress such that practically every congressperson had a full-time person just fielding the complaints. One of the obvious things, just routine transactions, were very, very hard. In 1 year, taxpayers got 400 million busy signals, and that was answering letters that were sent by the IRS, dunning letters. So they were complaining about routine business, and then there was also a lot of concern that the IRS was picking on the little guy and letting the fat cats get away. There was a big computer program that was declared a failure after spending $4 billion. So, and then there were the famous congressional hearings, the Senate hearings that you may remember, in which taxpayers were getting up and telling how the IRS was ruining their lives.
Poured out their horror stories of being interrogated and abused by IRS agents.
So-called horror stories.
Right.
And it all came to a head about the time that I got there. But the complaints have been growing for quite some time, actually.
You managed to come in and address some of those, but now here you are, you're out the other side, and you're still warning us. You say that the IRS is on a path that makes the whole tax system, to quote you, more and more unfair to the vast majority of taxpayers. How? Why?
Yeah, not so much the IRS, but the whole tax. The IRS is one part of the tax system. It's kind of, you might think of it as the manager or the administrator of the tax system. But the other parts of it are the tax code itself, which the IRS has absolutely no control over. That's obviously passed by Congress and by the presidents in each administration. And it's just been getting more and more and more complicated, bigger and bigger and bigger. I once tried to make that point at a congressional hearing about how big the tax code was. So I asked some of my tax experts in the IRS, how many pages are there in the tax code? And about 2 weeks later, they came back a little bit sheepishly and said, well, we don't really think you ought to use any number because it's changing so fast, nobody can agree.
So it's bigger, exactly, it's more complicated. Why does that make it more unfair, Charles Rosado?
Well, okay, because of the fact that the complications are one of the things that people that want to manipulate how they report their income make it possible to make it more feasible to do that. And there are plenty of promoters out there of all stripes that will take advantage of, show people how to take advantage of that. That's point number one. The second point, though, is that notwithstanding the fact that the code is getting more complicated and that the sheer size of the economy is growing substantially every year, the resources that were provided by the IRS to actually administer it were actually declining, not just going slower, but declining. So if you net it all out, it provide a wide open opportunity for those that didn't want to pay to just not do it.
And you paint a picture where there are a lot of people doing just that. Charles Rosado, we've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. Charles Rosado, former commissioner of the IRS, is with us. His new book is Many Unhappy Returns. You can join us as well. What's your response when the former chief of the IRS until 2002 says the whole tax system is becoming more and more unfair to the vast majority of taxpayers? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the former head of the IRS about what he calls the growing unfairness of the U.S. tax code and tax collection and what to do about it. Charles Rosado is my guest. He was IRS commissioner from 1997 to 2002. That's in the Clinton and the Bush administrations. He's a current member of President Bush's advisory panel for income tax reform. He's author of the new book, Many Unhappy Returns, One Man's Quest to Turn Around the Most Unpopular Organization in America. Charles Rosado, you say that the IRS can often look like a lone cop seeing crooks robbing all four banks on the corners of the main intersection in town and having no choice but to just watch three of them drive away. What do you mean?
Well, what it means is that just because of sheer numbers, lack of resources, not enough agents, that even the most serious cases that the IRS knows about when people are not paying their taxes, it can typically only go after maybe a quarter or 30% of them. And I'm not talking minor cases. I'm talking about the cases where people may be hiding income offshore or just flat not paying their taxes or not even filing returns.
So you say of the taxpayers who the IRS believed with high probability were either not filing returns at all, were using abusive trust or overseas accounts to hide income, or were underreporting very large amounts of income, more than 70% could not be pursued because of the lack of resources. It sounds shocking. Are we naive?
That's just a fact. I actually issued a report at the last month or two of my term that documented all these statistics and these points.
And that just goes on year after year, very large amounts of unreported income, while, you know, wage earners have it automatically deducted, so become automatic payers in, effectively. Is it a real split between, I don't know, rich tax scoff laws and wage-earning Joes? You describe it that way at some
point. Well, you know, what's interesting is that it really is a case where honesty, and lack of compliance spread all over all tax brackets. It's true that wage earners that have all the money withheld have less opportunity to cheat, although even there are some techniques that have been spread by some promoters. But basically what it boils down to is that about 80% plus of taxpayers are very honest and diligent in paying their taxes. And they're paying at least 15% extra to make up for the free riders.
So for those 80% who just pay their taxes and may not even know about the options, Describe some of the ways in which the other 20% get away with not, you know, paying their tab, even very large incomes unreported or unpaid.
Well, there was a case reported publicly because it went to an indictment just about 2 or 3 weeks ago of a man who was accused in this indictment of hiding $450 million of income that he made in the telecommunications industry in offshore bank accounts. And that made big news because it was a gigantic amount of money. But the only thing that was unusual about that case was that there aren't that many people that have $450 million to hide. But other than that, he was in the same kind of doing the same kind of thing that hundreds of thousands of other taxpayers were doing, just not with that gigantic amount of money.
And that
that's
kind of,
just one example.
That kind of tax shelter, you say, most often used by people with considerable money, often with business funds, not wages, but money earned through some business that they have some ownership of. Describe the kind of universe of tax shelters to the little people, us here, who pay our wage taxes. What's it look like? How's it work?
Well, there's as many ways of doing it as there are inventive promoters, but one way is exactly similar to what this taxpayer that was indicted for the $450 million is, just for smaller amounts. So people would have a business or whatever kind it would be, and they might even be partially wage earners but have some other business income. They just move the business into a trust account in a tax haven, and then in many cases, some of them were using credit cards, simple credit cards, to get the money back. So you put the money, the cash offshore, and then they open up a credit card issued by a bank in a tax haven, and when they need some cash, they just use the credit card to charge whatever they need or go to an ATM and get the cash out. That's just simply hiding income. Another technique that is more prevalent among large corporations and some very wealthy individuals would be to have promoters that are sophisticated tax people manipulate sections of the tax code to essentially contrive to have losses show up on their tax return and have the gains, the corresponding gains, show up by someplace that was not taxable, like a nonprofit organization or even a foreign entity. And they claim on their tax return that they're following the letter of the law, but in fact they're just manipulating the code to, and this is where the complexity comes in, they're just manipulating various sections of the code to
and they know it darn well, as you describe it.
Deductions they don't. Pardon me?
And they know it darn well, usually, as you described it anyway. They know they're stretching things to
sure.
the max.
But they may, in some of those cases, they may be able to get a lawyer to give them an opinion that says that, you know, under certain conditions, that this complies with the law. And by getting a legal opinion, that gives them a certain insulation against penalties if they get caught.
Now, you describe 70% of people that where there's a high probability that they're flouting the tax or they're not paying in is not even being touched. But even in those that the IRS goes after, as you describe it, Charles Rosati, in the tax shelter case, you say even if it's found that the deductions, that the shelter that they've arranged doesn't comply, that all that happens is they're asked to pay their taxes after all. There's no real penalty. It's like a loan from the government while it's sorted out.
That's not the way it's supposed to work, but that's the way it works out in practice, because in the way that the custom is developed in the courts, and since there is no direct statute that defines a tax shelter, the courts generally have held that if a person has an opinion from a lawyer that says this complied, even if it's a very stretched kind of an opinion, that they have to still pay back the tax if the court decides, but they generally are not required to pay the penalty. So it's kind of a heads I win, tails you lose. In other words, if I file one of these tax shelters and I don't get caught or I happen to win a court case, because sometimes they do win court cases, then I get a big windfall. And even if I do get caught and I have to pay back the tax, I've essentially gotten a loan.
Charles Rosati, if this is so well known and the government needs the revenue, we've seen the deficits, and there's the IRS sitting there. You were head of it for a long time. Why isn't the IRS put in a position to really go after these tax cheats or borderline cases? It would seem logical to go and get the revenue.
Well, you know, I came into the IRS from being in business, and many of the things that we were able to do in the IRS to try to import some business practices work pretty well. But when it comes to the federal budget, in the tax code, all I can say is logic has nothing to do with it that I was able to discover.
You mean you weren't given as commissioner a big enough budget to hire the staff to go out and bring in the taxes that were owed?
Well, I'll give you a statistic. In the 10 years prior to my departure, the number of tax returns, just the number of returns, never mind the tax code, increased by 16%, while the staff decreased by 16%. I don't mean percentage slowing down. I mean it actually had 15,000 fewer staff than it had 10 years before just because of the budget cuts.
So in whose interest is that? Why wouldn't Congress or the White House come in and fix that?
That's a question that I've been asking ever since I took office and was never able to get a good answer to. It doesn't make any sense. It's just that the IRS budget is not a very popular program. There's nothing more to it than that.
I mean,
until people begin to understand that they're the ones that end up paying the bill.
In other words, all the sort of honest taxpayers pay the bill for that revenue not being collected. Charles Rosati, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation for a moment David K. Johnston. He's a reporter with the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter there, author of Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everyone else. David K. Johnston, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So here's Charles Rosati, former commissioner of the IRS, coming out and saying it very plainly that this system is becoming more and more unfair to honest taxpayers. What's your explanation, David K. Johnston, for why that's not being addressed and fixed, if that's the case?
Well, because I think that there are two forces at work. One is it's relatively easy for Congress to require a regime that thoroughly captures wages. Your employer reports what your wages are, and it's expensive to have a regime that properly audits business owners, investors, and landlords because they're in control of the information. It doesn't just come in a computer to you like wage information does.
But is there any question that if you put the resources into it, you'd shake more money out of the tree than it cost you to shake the tree?
Well, I think you would shake a lot more money out of the tree if you did that, and I would point to the indictment of Walter Anderson, who was accused of being the biggest known tax cheat in the history of the Republic. In just 5 years, according to the IRS, he took in $450 million without
Charles Rosati just mentioned that, right.
Yes, and apparently that's only a portion of his income. There is a theory in law enforcement called general deterrence, and if the IRS had enough staff and had not constantly had this cutting in staff that Charles had to deal with during his tenure, and were able to go out and go after enough people at high income levels and make cases, lots of other people would alter their behavior as a result.
Charles Rosati, it sounds as though, well, you tell us, does the math add up? If you had the resources to put into gathering the revenue, would it outweigh the cost of that effort?
Well, absolutely. I mean, right now, even with the limited resources it has, the IRS brings in what's called enforcement revenue, which is just the money it gets from doing such cases, about $40 billion, which is about four times its budget, its total budget, not just its enforcement budget. And it isn't necessarily linear, and it isn't necessarily the right thing to just go after the cases that bring in the most enforcement revenue. But without question that by putting in more resources, you would bring in more revenue. The more important thing is, though, is what David K. Johnston said, is that it would have, as you get to the point where you're being more likely to get caught, having a deterrent effect on other people.
David, how should honest tax-paying citizens view this? I mean, it sounds like they ought to be outraged if they're picking up the slack.
It is an absolute outrage, and people should be very upset about it. And it's the people who pay the highest taxes who really ought to be upset. If your business competitor isn't paying taxes and the government's not going after them, they're able to underbid you. They're able to literally profit off their crimes. But the problem is that Congress is entirely in the thrall of what I call the political donor class, the people who they depend on for campaign contributions. And the message they've given is less regulation, less taxing, fewer audits. And as a result, we aren't having a rational discussion about taxes in Washington at all. Tax has become the most vile four-letter word in Washington these days.
Nobody wants to talk about it, but the unfairness, as Charles Rosati and David K. Johnston, the unfairness is growing. Callers, what do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is calling from East Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. In 1989, I was an employer and went out of business, and the quarterly returns were continually sent to me by the computer thinking I was still in business.
The IRS kept billing you.
Yes, and it got up to $50,000, and they put a lien on my house, and I eventually sent a letter to the director at that time, Mr. Rosati, and to this day it has never been solved. Now think, for a small guy, what that cost the United States government to play that game, $50,000 in interest and penalties that aren't even due.
That was due to some kind of clerical snafu, you're saying, Mark.
The computer continued to print out the quarterlies thinking that I still had 8 employees after I had closed the business.
So when you've been through that and you hear about somebody who's hidden $400 million in taxable income in 5 years, how do you feel?
It just makes you angry as a little guy. It's unbelievable, the problems. And I think it's the system that has to change. That's what needs to be done. The director is the director, and he came into probably a bad situation, hard to deal with all those problems. But I think this thing is just out of control, and it's unfair. Little guys, I have to fight them. I'm still fighting them. Nothing has ever happened.
Charles Rosati, here's a citizen begging for relief. Yeah. You must have had tens of thousands, maybe more.
And those kinds of problems, if that's the way it really happened, it should not happen, and I think fewer of them are happening. I would give advice to this gentleman that he ought to contact the taxpayer advocate, who is specifically set up to deal with those kind of cases that don't get resolved properly.
But that's one person in a country of 290.
No, it's not one person. There's a whole set of offices around the country that are designed to be a safety valve when something just doesn't work right.
Mark, I don't want to get into all the details, but a reality check, have you done that, Mark?
I did that, and I wrote a letter to the director 3 times, certified mail. I'm from Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. so it was easy for me to do. They called a month later and threatened me again. Not him, but whoever mm-hmm. he turned it over to went down the line. And the next call I got was from an IRS agent telling me they were going to take my house and do stuff like that. That's what happens. It never changes. 16 years. And I did the advocate stuff. I did all that.
That's a long time.
If I can jump
David,
in.
David, yes, please.
All law enforcement agencies have problems like this, but clearly the IRS, because its computer systems were antiquated, because its culture was not designed to address problems like this, had big problems with it. This is actually an area where the IRS has made a lot of progress. I'm surprised the taxpayer advocate hasn't resolved this, because the feedback I've gotten from people is that generally they've done quite a good job of getting onto these cases and trying to get them resolved. And absolutely, if you're a small business owner and you're getting nailed like this over something when there's no issue, it's a waste of the taxpayers' money, and it's infuriating.
Mark, we feel your pain, as a former president once said, and we wish you luck in getting it sorted out. Drop Charles Rosati's name a little louder with the tax advocate. Charles Rosati, you've got a chapter in the book, Many Unhappy Returns, entitled Why People Think the IRS Picks on the Little Guy. Are you suggesting by that it doesn't?
Well, I think that the point of the chapter was, at least at the time that I got there, that the IRS simply had become quite out of date in its enforcement programs, as well as in the way it dealt with routine business transactions like answering the phone. And so what was happening was, even though they had fewer resources, they weren't necessarily using them in the most effective way. And it wasn't that anybody wanted to pick on the little guy. I mean, that really was not it at all, so much as they were just really out of date by a long, long period of time.
You're
for
right.
example,
mm-hmm.
they hadn't updated their income distributions, for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. So the highest bracket for audits was 100, the highest bracket for allocating audits was $100,000 at a time when 60% of the income tax was due by people over $100,000. And I could go on and on. Some of the points that David Kaye made about business income, new forms of businesses such as limited liability corporations,
right.
and but we're not really being given any attention, not because nobody cared, but because they just hadn't grown up with the time. So the one thing we were able to do was, even though we didn't have enough resources, the resources that they did have for auditing and collections were considerably redirected towards higher income taxpayers, corporations, offshore issues, and things of that kind. And my successor, Commissioner Everson, has continued that even more aggressively, which I think is a good thing. I mean, even if you don't have enough resources, to do what you should at least take the ones you do have and use them efficiently. So that was a change, I think, for the better, and is continuing, actually. But it only goes so far. I mean, you know, you can maybe stop one of the four robbers on the four corners, but you still have the other three going away.
David K. Johnston with the New York Times, please stick with us. And Charles Rosati, former commissioner of the IRS. New book is Many Unhappy Returns, One Man's Quest to Turn Around the Most Unpopular Organization in America. You can join us tonight. Do you fill out your return with sweaty palms, with fear of the IRS? Are you paying your tab without complaint? Have you figured out a dodge? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the former head of the IRS about what he calls the growing unfairness of the U.S. tax code and tax collection and what to do about it. Charles Rosati is with us. He's author of the new book, Many Unhappy Returns. We're also joined tonight by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times business reporter, author of Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to the benefit of the super rich and cheat everyone else. You can join the conversation tonight. Can the country tolerate more and more of the tax burden being, in Charles Rosati's words, paid by a smaller and smaller fraction of willing taxpayers? And is it time to tear up the tax code and simplify it to drive out iniquities? Or do you trust that that will work for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nancy's calling from Boston. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show. I want to go back to this issue of simplification because a lot of people put out the idea, well, let's just go to a flat tax or some other kind of simple kind of tax, and that'll solve the problem.
A lot of that talk right now.
Let's put aside the fact that flat taxes are almost entirely regressive and be very difficult to design it so it's not regressive. The real problem I have with simplifying the tax code is that a lot of these high-end taxpayers find more and more clever and subtle ways of defining income, defining assets, defining gains, defining losses. And first of all, you can simplify it and then you'll miss all this now, but second of all, people will find new loopholes, and so you got to go after those.
But isn't the complexity of the code what makes it possible to find so many loopholes, Nancy?
No, I'd say the other way around, that the complexity of the code is in response to the loopholes that people will continue creatively to discover and try to implement.
Nancy, thanks for your call. Charles Rosati, help us look ahead here. What's your prescription? It's not your job. It wasn't your job, but if you had to change the tax code, Nancy says simplify, and you got more trouble. What do you say?
Well, I'm afraid I'd have to disagree with the caller on that point because I think that the complexity has been put in by both Republicans and Democratic administrations in both the White House and in Congress over the last 10 years, putting more and more special provisions in for this purpose. Maybe some of them are well-intentioned to try to provide an incentive for this kind of a business, to try to provide a break for this kind of a family situation or business situation. And the more of those that are created, the more opportunity there is for people to manipulate them to sort of glide through the tax code. And in addition to that, it uses up a tremendous amount of resources for both taxpayers and the IRS. I mean, one figure that I'll give to you is that if all the people in three cities the size of Boston worked all year round just filling out tax forms, it wouldn't add up to the total number of hours that people in this country spend. Okay, and that doesn't include the IRS hours. That's just the taxpayer hours.
The millions
so
and millions.
It uses
and millions.
Up a. It's over. It would be equivalent to 2 million people working all year round just filling out tax forms, which is an enormous waste. But of course, when you just think about it, that provides an opportunity for both honest mistakes as well as intentional, you know, manipulation. So the complexity is part of it. It absolutely is part of it. I think that there also needs to be a more explicit law against tax shelters. One of the oddities that I discovered being a business person is there actually is no law against tax shelters. There's court cases that go back 70 years that go to the issue of people manipulating the tax code, and there have been you know, conflicting cases all over the place.
Just
about
a giant pile of precedent that's cited.
Yeah, a giant pile of precedents. And naturally, when you have that, you have, you know, this case that goes this way and that case that goes that way. There have been some recent cases that the IRS has litigated, for example, against people doing tax shelters where the court has essentially said, you know, as long as they comply with the letter of these technical regulations, that that's okay. Other courts take the opposite opinion. And Congress has been unwilling so far to legislate a flat prohibition that takes the position that tax shelters are illegal. The Senate did pass an amendment, but it was not passed by the whole Congress.
And David K. Johnston, you're saying because so many of their big money supporters have an interest in those shelters. But David, I wanted to ask you if you'd look ahead with us here. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way taxes are collected and outlined now. The Bush administration talked about tax reform, maybe put off now for another year, but there's talk about flat tax, about a value-added tax. Do you see a real reform movement coming along here, and is it one that would address the kind of skewed dynamic to advantage the wealthy that you describe in your book?
No, I don't see a serious effort at reform. Remember that for lots of Americans, the tax system is simple. 70% of Americans fill out what amounts to a postcard tax return.
But Charles Rossetti describes them as chumps in a way, because the other 30%, you know, are playing all kinds of games.
But if you're a low or moderate income American, there's nothing you can do to reduce your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people fill out a simple return. It is, as we get into the top quarter of Americans and their income, and particularly the very wealthy and corporations, that we see all this complexity. Now, the flat tax doesn't do anything to address the problem of defining what is income, which is one of the most complicating factors in the tax code.
And this is where the tax shelter comes in, of course.
That's exactly correct, and deferring into the future. In addition to that, if we adopt another system, a consumption tax, a national retail sales tax, all of these have good sides and bad sides, but to think that Congress won't muck them up with favors they've traded campaign contributions for, just as they've done with the tax code, is lunacy. Of course they're going to do that. We need to change the way Congress does this. No more middle-of-the-night bills. There usually are not hearings on tax bills. Nobody will own up to who authored the provisions of them. You know, that's an area where we need real sunshine and fundamental reform.
Charles Rossetti, you ring some pretty big alarm bells here. You write, the American tax system is based on the willingness of all citizens to calculate and pay the taxes they owe, based on the understanding that if they don't, the IRS will intervene. And you write, if the IRS is thought to ignore rich and powerful taxpayers who don't comply, the most basic principle of the tax system is undermined. A country can't really afford that. You're on the president's income tax reform panel. So what are you suggesting? What do you propose?
Well, let me just make one point, though, that I think is important not to lose sight of here, is that most upper-income taxpayers are also honest. I mean, and in a sense, by them,
that's absolutely true.
And they're actually paying disproportionate amount of this noncompliance also. If you just took it as a percentage, I mean, if somebody is paying $500,000 in tax and they're paying 15% more than they need to, they're paying $75,000 more than they need to. So, I mean,
granted, all honest taxpayers have an interest here.
Fortunately, it's not just the lower-income people that are getting cheated, if you will. It's everybody that's honest, and most of the people in all tax brackets are honest. I just want to make that point.
But I am quoting you here, and you realize that this impression is growing, and it's growing because of the very complexity and exploitation that you describe.
So I think that what is required, I respectfully disagree with my friend here, Mr. Johnston. I believe that there is a possibility of dramatically simplifying the tax code. And I just gave some very small examples, very limited examples in my book. It could be, I believe that there's much bigger opportunities than that. Not that that in itself would solve the problem, because I think it would be a help. It would be an important help. But I think
you do
also need some resources.
Are you saying flat tax, value-added tax? Which direction?
Well, I'm not talking about any specific form, because I can't get into that. But in
why
know,
not?
Being on the panel? Well, because I'm a member of this panel, and we're just beginning our deliberations.
Tom?
But,
yes, David?
Tom,
yes?
I agree with Charles that there may be some passage of reform. I just think that we will soon see Congress muck it up the way they have the existing tax code. We certainly need simplification. We shouldn't be having all this deadweight effort put into tax avoidance. We need to come up with smarter ways to tax. We have a tax system that was well designed for a national industrial wage economy. That's not the world we're in anymore. We are in a global services asset world, and we need to have a tax code that greases the wheels of commerce, encourages investment, rewards good behavior, catches people who try to cheat.
Well, you know what? I wish that I had captured that right, because that's a very good statement. I agree with that. And I think that it is quite possible. I do want to say that the two prongs of this to fix are the code and the budget. You can't really solve the problem without both.
The tax code, the tax law, and the budget for enforcement.
For the IRS, that's right. And it's not a lot of money that you need, by the way. We're talking very, very small amounts compared to the trillions that we collect.
Which makes it all the more amazing that it's not there. Let me get one more call here. Ray is calling from Manhattan. Hi, Ray, you're on the air.
Yes. I suggest that very severe penalties for tax cheats like life imprisonment, and you wouldn't have to imprison too many before the rest of the community who is in that game would catch on. Working class and lower class people, of course, don't have crimes that have a different rationality or maybe no rationality. So one thing you could do is enhance the penalties of such a severe nature that it would percolate throughout the whole upper echelon community.
We got it, Ray, and our time is short. Charles Rosati, time to set up a guillotine?
Well, I actually had a visit once from an official from China who was setting up a tax system, and he wanted to know how we did it. And about a month after we went back, somebody sent me a note that he had gone back and instituted the death penalty for tax evasion, and they accused me of giving that idea to him, but it really wasn't my idea. There actually are reasonably severe penalties if you can prove someone committed a crime, but you know, in this country, you have to prove proof beyond a reasonable doubt to prove somebody committed a crime, which is a pretty high standard. So people that cut corners, let's say, which is probably the majority, as opposed to doing something as egregious as Mr. Anderson did, wouldn't be affected at all by that. It also doesn't deal with the tax shelter issue, where people get accountants and lawyers and sometimes courts to agree that they're literally technically complying with the provisions of the law, but they're still sheltering large amounts of income. So I think it's fine to have criminal prosecutions. And one of the things that we did while I was there was to redirect IRS resources to put more emphasis on tax crimes. But it's not the whole solution.
David K. Johnson, we just got half a minute left. If you're a citizen listening tonight, what's your advice about where to bring the heat?
Go to Congress. Tell your member of Congress that, you know, you want fair and honest tax enforcement. And how interesting that the IRS is one of the few profit centers of the government, and yet it's being starved for revenue, and it benefits cheats and it hurts honest taxpayers. That's an outrage, and people ought to complain in those terms about it.
It's not a pretty picture. Charles Rosati, just a couple seconds left. Do you think Congress could deliver a fair tax code to this country?
I think it takes the president and the Congress, but I do believe that it's possible, absolutely.
Well, we'll go out on an optimistic note, and we'll hope that that might happen. Charles Rosati, former commissioner of the IRS, author of many unhappy returns, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And David K. Johnston at the New York Times, author of Perfectly Legal, thank you very much for being with us, David.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, a rare recorded speech by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. This is On Point. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia famously doesn't like to be around cameras and microphones. Last April, for example, a reporter's tape was seized by a U.S. Marshal and erased after she had recorded a speech the justice had delivered in Mississippi. But today, the cameras and tape recorders were rolling as Scalia spoke at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington. In the speech, Scalia lamented the encroachment of politics onto federal benches from both sides of the political divide, reminding his audience that he was confirmed 98-0 despite his known conservative political views. He said that judges should be selected from among those who can best interpret the Constitution as it is written. Here's an excerpt from Scalia's speech.
If we're selecting lawyers, If we're selecting people to read a text and give it its the fair meaning it had when it was adopted, yes, the most important thing to do is to get a good lawyer. If, on the other hand, we're picking people to draw out of their own conscience and experience a new constitution with all sorts of new values to govern our society, then we should not look principally for good lawyers. We should look principally for people who agree with us, the majority, as to whether there ought to be this right, that right, and the other right. We want to pick people who will write the new constitution that we would want. And that's why you hear in the discourse on this subject, people talking about moderate. We want moderate judges. What is a moderate interpretation of a text? You're halfway between what it really means and what you'd like it to mean? There's no such thing as a moderate interpretation of a text. Would you ask a lawyer, draw me a moderate contract? The only way the word has any meaning is if you are looking for somebody to write a law, to write a constitution, rather than to interpret one. I think the very terminology suggests where we have arrived, at the point of selecting people to write a constitution rather than people to give us the fair meaning of one that has been democratically adopted. And when that happens, when the Senate interrogates nominees to the Supreme Court or to the lower courts, you know, Judge so-and-so, do you think there's a right to this in the Constitution? You don't. Well, my constituents think that there ought to be, and I'm not going to appoint to the court somebody who's not going to find that. When we are in that mode, you realize we have rendered the Constitution useless, because the Constitution will mean what the majority wants it to mean. The senators are representing the majority, and they will be selecting justices who will devise a Constitution that the majority wants. And that, of course, deprives the Constitution of its principal utility. The Bill of Rights is meant to protect you and me against whom do you think? The majority. My most important function on the Supreme Court is to tell the majority to take a walk. And the notion that the justices ought to be selected because of the positions that they will take that are favored by the majority is a recipe for the destruction of what we've had for 200 years.
Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia speaking today at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.